You're listening to the Innovators Podcast with Tom Kennedy, unpacking the stories of industry leaders in search of the tools, tips, and tricks that make them who they are today.
We can tell I'm new to this whole podcasting game. I just managed to record what I thought was the perfect intro, and then I realized I had not pushed record on the recorder. So let's try this once again. This is take two, and I'm Tom Kennedy, and welcome to the Innovators Podcast. I'm going to be unpacking the stories of industry-leading innovators in search of the tools, tips, and tricks that make them who they are. And so far, it's been an amazing journey. We've had some amazing guests like Chris Rawlinson, Aisha Pandor, Steely Shara Lambus. Hope I pronounced his name correctly, but he'll probably say I haven't no matter what. We've also had Dan May, Scary Tirola, and Professor Timothy Noakes all come on the show. So you can expect an episode out every 2 weeks. And it's going to be, I'm hoping we're going to be sharing some really amazing stories and inspiring stories. At the end of the day, a lot of people have said, why are you starting a podcast and why is it called or focused on innovation? The reason is podcasts have sort of hit the mainstream. It seems to be sort of the growing medium, the way people are deciding to share insightful stories, share different lessons. And it's something that really resonates well with me. I've listened to podcasts for years now, slightly obsessed, you could say. So the idea of starting one has always been at the back of my mind, and I just feel like now's the time. So the objective is to share inspiring stories. I believe building brands and businesses is super hard. I think we all know that. And a lot of the time we see these people we sort of consider successful, but we don't know what goes on behind the scenes. And we don't know how the journey unfolded. And it's the idea of sharing what they went through, that they experienced real struggle, real fear, real anxiety, those questioning moments, am I doing the right thing? But at the end of the day, they got through to the other side. And I think it's that takeaway that we can all sort of take that, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And yes, it may be difficult, but the rewards outweigh the struggles and risks at the end of the day. I'm a firm believer that the future will be built in Africa, and I believe entrepreneurship and innovation are among the most important things we can try to do. We're the most likely the best way we can try and change the world for the better. So I'm hoping by having these amazing guests on, sharing their stories, that they'll inspire people to get outside and just do some crazy stuff, build brands, build products, change the world. That's a great way to introduce you to Nick Haralambos, the first guest on the show. He's CEO and of style company NickHarry.com. Nick's had a very colorful past. He's had successes, he's had failures. He's someone I've actually known for about 8 years. I met him back then in a friend's living room, where he even then proceeded to share some amazing insights into building a business in South Africa in particular, and it sort of just stuck with me. And then a couple of years later, I was part of a tech incubator called 88 Miles Per Hour, and in walked Nick as one of the mentors and proceeded to share even more nuggets of wisdom about building brands and tackling business. Nick has a really great way of looking at the world, looking at building brands, looking at how you should be trying to tackle growth and tackle product development and a whole bunch of things. I think there's a lot of great takeaways, a lot of lessons to be learned from what he has to say. And yeah, I'm hoping you guys will enjoy it just as much as I did chatting to him in studio. And before I go into the interview, I'd also like to say feedback is always welcome. I actually thrive off it, whether negative or positive. So please give me a shout if you have any ideas, suggestions, criticisms. You can get hold of me on all the social networks at TKennedySA. Or you can go to the website for the show, theinnovators.co, where you can find all the show notes, relevant links, information, and all sorts of stuff chatted about during the episode. This show is not brand supported, so if you want to support us in any way, shape, or form, the best way you can do it is by sharing the episode. Just a simple share on all your social networks or a review on iTunes would be hugely appreciated. So without further ado, let's hop right in. This is Nick Haralambos, the CEO of Nick Harry. Enjoy. I'm sitting here with Nick Haralambos, the founder of Nick Harry. He's got a very interesting story.
that culminates in him taking on building a brand, a global brand, and tackling retail in the time of the retail apocalypse, which he'll hopefully be elaborating on just now. So let's go back to the beginning. Do you feel you had an entrepreneurial edge when you were a kid or when you were younger at school? Is there one of those Gary Vaynerchuk stories where you had multiple lemonade stands or anything like that?
Yeah, man, I wish that there was, but one of my regrets now is that I didn't start building businesses earlier. So when I was in school, I kind of just followed the rules. Didn't really do anything overboard crazy. One of the things that I don't think most people know about me is I got my first tattoo when I was about 15. And that was kind of my way to give a big FU to the world and say, you know, yeah, I'm following the rules, but I got my own thing going on. But in terms of entrepreneurial stuff, I finished my education in high school at a good Catholic school in Sandton. I went to Grahamstown to study journalism, politics, and philosophy because I wanted to be a war correspondent. That was my thing from when I was like 7.
Can we just quickly unpack that? Yeah. You wanted to be a war correspondent?
Yeah, I must have seen a movie or something. And from the age of 7, I wanted to be a war correspondent. I wanted to go into active war zones and tell the story of what was happening there. And I think the movie might have even been, and I don't know if the times line up here, but Harrison's Flower. If you haven't seen that, great movie about war correspondents. And I was kind of moved to be a journalist and tell stories. And I have a history of that in my family. One of my uncles was an apartheid reporter, and he disappeared. He one day went to Vic Falls on holiday and never came back.
Oh, really?
Because he was reporting against apartheid. So, and that was it. He was never seen again. So I started my first company when I was 18 at university, and it was a student news aggregator. So I've been in media for a while. I mean, geez, now 15, 16 years. And that business just, it was an interesting learning experience. We didn't charge anything. Students don't want to spend money. They don't care about the news. And yeah, so 18 was my first business venture, and I wish I'd started 10 years earlier.
But would you consider that, was it a successful business?
Massive flop. Okay. Massive flop. My first eight businesses were massive flops.
Yeah, I've also got the big first failure that I had also 18 to 19. But I consider that, I call it my mini MBA now.
Straight up.
Just high pressure, feeling of failure, like fighting against it, young age. I think it's one of the reasons I've never really worked for anyone. It was horrible, but at the same time, just so like eye-opening.
Yeah, I call people like us unemployable.
I was told that quite recently, actually. Yeah. Someone said you are literally, no one wants someone like you working for them.
Absolutely.
People like us, I guess, sort of go against the grain.
Yeah,
especially when it comes to big corporate.
Completely. I'm happy to go in and consult and then leave, but that's about it.
Okay. So you studied journalism. That's an interesting, and you wanted to be a war correspondent.
Yeah.
You then were in a band for a short period of time.
I was. I would actually consider that one of my earliest businesses too. And I didn't realize it at the time. And it's interesting, we're sitting in the Red Bull Studios with all this music surrounding us. But that was a business. And music is a business. It's not about the music. Yes, the music's important, but there are hundreds of millions of people who can play a better song than the bands that are there. And that band was a business. And we stunk out the house because we weren't a good business. We could play music, but we didn't wrap up contracts properly. We didn't monetize what we were doing. The age of the internet hadn't really dawned yet, so it was hard to get distribution. I remember releasing songs that Algoa FM played one time. And like, how do you get known when that's your audience? So
stickers,
lanyards, you name it, thumb drives.
Back in the days of the sticker, sticker was the key driver for building brand awareness back in the day.
Absolutely.
So what was the name of the band?
I'd really, really rather not say. No, it was called Thus Far.
Okay, yeah. And you actually did vocals and played guitar.
Yeah, so I wrote the music with the band. We actually all wrote the music together. I played guitar, and we swapped instruments a lot. It was quite interesting, except for the drummer. We had a violinist who could play guitar. We had a guitarist who could play bass, and I could play bass and sing, and our singer could play guitar. So we kind of all swapped on stage as well. We would swap through the
set. So if we go Google Thus Far, will we find any?
Not much. I challenge you to Google and see what you can find.
I accept. Challenge accepted. So, do you think, have you had a creative sort of bone in your body from a young age. You obviously were interested in music. Did you now very style and design focused, which we'll get to shortly. But do you have a creative side? Do you feel that you're a creative person?
Yeah, I do. I think I do, but I never really considered it. I never considered myself a creative person. I think now, as I've gotten older, that's also become less part of my day-to-day life, which separates me from it a bit. But bearing my soul a little, when I was in high school, I took art as one of my subjects. I taught myself to play guitar when I was 13. My parents, goodness knows why, but they let me draw on my walls. So I would paint my walls and draw whatever I wanted. We obviously owned and lived in the house we owned. And I used to write poetry and like short stories. And the older I got, the more focused on business I got, the less those creative things were part of my life. But coming into Nick Harry, that's become a big focus for me. I'm a non-formally trained designer who built a design company.
Okay. I'm curious about that link between creativity and business, because I feel like the more I chat to people who've been successful and you unpack their earlier days, there's usually some element of creativity. And I think even just building brands and being involved in business, you sort of have to have that creative side. You have to think a bit differently to the normal people.
Definitely. There is an article, or I can't even think of where I discovered this, but it's the T-shaped person. And if you're listening, hold your hands up like Mr. T would when he was on TV. And it's a jack of all trades and a master of one. So today I believe that that's what people need to thrive in the world where everyone can code or everyone can design or everyone can talk and everyone can podcast. You need to be good at a lot of things and excel at something. And I would argue that CEOs are generally creative people who are better at business. And artists are generally bad business people, but business people who are better at art. But they still have to have a bit of both. Picasso
almost correlates against one another.
Absolutely. And you have to have one to have the other. You can't be William Kentridge without knowing how to sell a 10 million rand painting. It just doesn't work that way. So you need to have both, otherwise you never get discovered.
Very true. Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point too. Yeah. So let's go back to Motribe. So Motribe wasn't your first business, but I guess it's your biggest. Let's not say biggest, but it's your first real sort of
well-known thing.
You were known for Motribe. I remember that's when I first met you back in the day. You were giving me some great advice back then about how to tackle technology companies. How did Motribe come to be?
Yeah,
let's hear the story.
So
there.
That actually goes back quite far even. I studied journalism, as we've covered, and my lecturer at the time helped me build one of my first businesses. His name was Vincent. And Vincent then went on to Mail and Guardian to be the head of their online underneath Matthew Buckland. I then joined them as the head of mobile, and Vincent and I both left and went to Vodacom. So from Vodacom, we'd worked together for about 18 months to 2 years, and we kind of both got a bit edgy. And the thing that tipped us leaving Vodacom, we calculated how much our entire 2 year budget was for Vodacom in turnover, and it equated to 8 hours of turnover was our 2 year budget. And we just thought, what the hell are we doing here? Like, we had 40 coders working for us, and we'd gotten a social network of like 1.8 to 2 million people in 2 years. And we were just making no dents.
What was this? The grid?
No. This was the grid. This was Foursquare before there was Foursquare.
Yeah, I remember the days of the grid.
Yeah, basically feature phone Foursquare. Feature phones don't have smartphone screens, if you're listening. And we decided that we should leave and raise funding and move to Cape Town. What we did was, in our holidays and our downtime from Vodacom, we built a test network called Emo Fwens. With a W, Emo Fwens. And it was an emo social network for emo kids. And the whole premise was that you can come and join Motribe and build your own social network for your own offbeat little network. So we were a social network builder for mobile phones. That's what we did. Left Vodacom, raised money, and moved to Cape Town.
Can I quickly go back to So did you build Emo Fwens as Emo Fwens and then realize you almost had an enterprise play where you could license the same tech out?
The enterprise play came after lots of toil. So we built Emo Friends as a standalone network. We saw the traction and we're like, ooh, what other networks can we build? Then we thought, hold on, don't other people want to build networks too? Let's build the tech that builds the network, then push that out.
It's the classic South African B2C is hard, B2B makes money.
Exactly.
Yeah, so everyone,
and we fought that hard. We fought that B2C thing hard. Actually, until we sold, we fought that hard. We did not want to be the uncool profitable business. We wanted to be the cool business with 2 million users. And ultimately, that was our downfall and exit strategy.
Successful exit? I know it's like not widely known or reported on or anything like that. Was it, in your eyes, do you see it as a successful exit? Like-
So it was about 5 years ago now, and I think I've got the hindsight to talk about it. It was a profitable exit. As a personal exit, I don't feel like it was a success. I didn't want to sell. My partners wanted to sell, and they did what they thought was necessary, all things considered. The way the network was growing, the way that the business was going, the way that the ecosystem was looking, and the way that our partnership had developed. So Vincent and our investors decided to sell the business, and I jumped on board, kicking and screaming, but I jumped on board. And it ended up being profitable for everyone financially.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, which I count as a success.
Did you see, what was your reasoning? Did you see more potential? Did you see that?
I was an emotional, egotistical kid. That's why.
You just love the business and love the feeling again?
No, I was scared of the idea of letting go of something that I was comfortable in. And it wasn't comfortable. I mean, it was possibly the worst 3 years of my life. Just so stressed, so unbelievably focused on the next vanity metric bullshit. So I ended up going with the exit. And I didn't want to exit because I thought we could do more, and we just become profitable. But ultimately, the tech wasn't supporting our vision, and the vision wasn't supporting the tech. So there was a massive break in building this business. And fortunately, our investors had the foresight to go, stop, exit, start again. And it, in hindsight, it was the best decision.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's MoTribe up to these days?
MoTribe exited to Mixit, and Mixit shut down last year.
Okay.
So that's...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Makes you aware of that. Okay, yeah, it's interesting. So you now, you've left MoTribe. Mm-hmm. Did you take some time to find yourself and travel the world and sort of bask in the glory of an exit? Or
no.
How did you take? What did you do?
I took it hard. Jumping forward a little bit, which we can talk about this in more detail once I'm done with the MoTribe transition. But I started seeing a psychologist recently. I call him my mental coach. Because entrepreneurs don't have perspective on what they're going through. We think we do and we don't. And if I had had a psychologist when I exited MoTribe, it would have been a significantly easier exit. So we exited and I was depressed, genuinely, severely, deeply depressed about the exit and what I'd gone through. And it was actually more like a divorce, because you get rid of this thing that's probably good that you've gotten rid of, but it's comfortable, so you want to hold on to it. So I went through a very severe 3-month depression. I literally sat in my socks and underwear watching TV for 3 months. Thank goodness my partner, Jen, who's now my business partner in Nikari.com, she got me through that and helped me and let me just wallow in my own dirt for 3 months, and eventually climbed out of it. I mean, entrepreneurs, I like to say that we're a little bit broken, and we don't know how to not do it again. And that's what makes us broken, is any other human being who experiences the failure we experience would stop and go and get a corporate job and be cushy for the rest of their lives.
I could not agree more with that statement.
Yeah.
It's almost like it's the, even for me, business has been extremely difficult, extremely stressful, extremely painful.
Why do we keep doing it?
People do say, why are you doing what you're doing?
Yeah.
It is. It's that, like, what else would I be doing?
Yeah.
Like, I think if I went to a 9-to-5, it just wouldn't resonate with me.
And I'd be making more money, like significantly more money than I'm making now. But it's not about that. It's about building something great. And that's kind of the focus that we have now. So from MoTribe into style, at Nikari, we don't use the word fashion, because we believe fashion is what other people tell you is cool, and style is what you want to wear. It's what you think is cool. So I went into style because I was frustrated with the lack of option available to men. And I have been for decades. Walk into a YDE, walk into an Edgar's, you can't walk into a Stutterford's for very much more longer. And what you see is 90% women and 10% men. And that frustrates me. Why is it that women are allowed to wear pants or skirts or colored tops, or and men are allowed to wear chinos and a white shirt? And it kills me. So we decided to see what we could do locally. We are now, to sum up the business today, we're an environmentally conscious, local production, and animal-free company. We don't use animal products, no leather. We don't test on animals. We do everything we can locally. So we're conscious about that. So we wanted to build a business producing local product, and I wanted to get into e-commerce. So having exited Motribe and looking at the state of the country and the world, what I thought was the next trend was e-commerce. On top of that, I'd done a lot of reading by reading of Elon Musk and his vertical integration with Tesla. He owns the mine that makes the product, that makes the battery that goes into the Tesla to bring his costs down. So we wanted to do something where we could own as much of the vertical as possible. Okay, we wanted to own the sock machine, dye the bamboo. We wanted to do the distribution ourselves and have no middlemen in between. That's why we don't do wholesale right now. It's because we want to keep our margin. So I looked at all of the different things are open to me, and I started the business with a very specific type of model. I wanted to prove to South Africans that you can spend 5,000 Rand in 30 days or 6 weeks and build a business off that. So the model was, take that 5,000 Rand, do it for 30 days, and if you can't make a profit, stop and start again on something else. Rapid development. Yeah. And the reason we chose 5,000 Rand is any South African, the lowest salary bracket is 3.5 grand a month. You can save 500 Rand a month for 12 months and save yourself five grand.
Okay, that's nice.
So we wanted to show that you don't need a lot of money. You don't need any particular background. You can save and be patient and build a business. And the first one we picked was socks. And
awesome.
5 years later, here we are.
Worked out really well.
Yeah.
I'm curious about what... Did you analyze the market, or were you just trying to solve a problem for yourself? Because you said you noticed, yes, you've got all these options for women, but they weren't for men. Was this just something you felt, I'm going to solve this because it's an issue for me? Yeah. Or did you also go, let me look at these various verticals? I feel there's, like, how did you approach, okay, socks, men, this is where I'm going? Was it a gut feel, or did you actually take data and analyze?
In hindsight, it's a combination of a lot of things. So the first thing was, I was scratching an itch. I didn't like Happy socks. They were imported, they were expensive, they weren't good quality, and I believed that where we were going in the next 10 years was local. I think everyone wants to build local and buy local. So at Nick Harry, we take the view of local everywhere. When we launch in the US officially, we will try and make socks in the US so that people in America can buy American socks. That's local everywhere. So that was our first approach. Then I looked at e-commerce and I thought, what can we do that avoids returns? So we don't do sizing. We don't do anything that's breakable. We don't do anything that does reverse logistics. The reason is a company like Harry's, their major cost, or Bonobos, is reverse logistics. Sending stuff back from the customer to the business. It's an unnecessary cost that is purely cost.
And there's especially, South Africa.
With courier companies.
Yeah, it's a nightmare.
So we wanted something light, something that doesn't do returns. If you have a problem with one of our pairs of socks and you've ordered online, we just send you another one. Take the one you don't like and give it to a friend. Like, just keep it. Then on top of that, we decided to do that model because customer service is king. And South Africa, customer service is so easy to be good at because everyone else is so bad at it.
So terrible, yeah.
So we just ignored all the defaults and we said, we're just going to build in any returns or any free socks we give away as part of our customer service cost. So whenever we have a complaint, we see it as a sale. If you're complaining to Nick Harry, there is a chance we can turn you and make you buy something else from us.
That raises an interesting point. I was listening to... I was actually at startup school with Y Combinator. I was going through their videos, and they discuss if you can, emotion's almost a standard variable. If you can turn an angry, irate customer or user and take advantage of that moment to shift them to and give them a positive experience, they'll often become your biggest advocates.
Absolutely.
That emotional shift just pulls them over to the other side.
Bang on. The anger we get when people spend money with us and have a sock that's ripped. That anger and the passion behind that anger can easily be turned into passion for support.
Yeah.
Because you just have to fix their problem. And most businesses in South Africa are so bad at doing customer service that people are default fight mode. Their default is fight. Whereas our default is, you're right. Absolutely, this is unacceptable. We'll send you a new pair. Done. So we decided to use socks as our test product. We met with a factory in Cape Town who were really nice. We got really lucky. We still work with them to this day. We've actually helped buy sock machines with them that we now own in the machine, in the factory. And we got lucky and put out our first three designs, and within 30 days we'd sold 600 pairs through Superbalist, which was then City Mob, and 5,000 rand had become 30,000 rand, and we just started to roll from there.
I want to also just elaborate on the product side of things. So yeah, there's obviously probably people listening, and there's thousands of people who go, I want to make watch straps, or I want to make wallets.
Yeah,
and I think it's the common problem. I have an idea, but now I need to execute. But when you're making something, there's a whole new, I guess it actually applies to anything, but I've always had this feeling like making a physical product must be this ordeal. Like, did you just go onto Google and sort of Google sock manufacturers, and
literally,
next thing you're in, where, I don't know where your manufacturing is, but you're in the middle of nowhere walking into a sock factory.
Bang on, that is how it happened.
But then Googled, like, minimum orders and all these sorts of things was like...
Yeah, all those things matter. So I was in that little funk, so there was no going down for me. There was only going up. So I picked a product that I wanted to make, and I thought, can I make this? And we Googled, literally Googled, Cape Town Sock Factory. And we went through the list of 10, and we phoned them all, and we told them what we wanted to do. And the one that sounded positive, we went and met with them.
And that relationship still exists to this day.
We now talk to them on a daily basis. They help develop product with us. But it's not an easy thing. I mean, what we were doing at the time, 5 years ago, no one was doing. Happy Socks was the only company in the world that was doing brightly colored crazy socks as their core business, and all the factories in South Africa didn't. So we met with these guys, and they were like, no, we can't do that. I was like, but you can't, or you don't want to? And they were like, we don't want to because we never have. And I was like, okay, that's different to can't. So I like to, in my 20s, I like to be the loudest, smartest person in the room. As I hit 29, 30, and now onto 33, I like to be the dumbest, quietest person in the room. So I said to this factory, I'm sorry, just tell me exactly, like I'm five, explain to me like I'm a five-year-old, why you can't make me this barbershop sock. And they couldn't. I was like, okay, cool, so you can make them. They're like, yeah, we can, but who's going to buy them? I was like, oh, that's my problem. Your problem is making them, my problem is selling them. And we just decided to dive in head first. If you've got a product that you want to make and you understand why you want to make it, then go ahead and make it. If you want to make a wallet that's leather, go find out if you can make it better than the people who are making them already. If you can't, then don't do it. If you've got some unique selling proposition, a USP, then go for it. Our unique selling proposition at the time was local made, bamboo fiber, and different designs. So we had a reason to sell, and we went for it.
Interesting. So now you started as socks. We're both actually wearing a pair. I'm wearing the classic barbershop one that you just spoke about.
Yeah.
But you socks took off. Mm. You started doing really well. Mm. You started then looking to do new products. And I'm fascinated by product iteration and how you decided, okay, tie clips is my next approach. And how am I going to do this differently? Did you then sort of test small batches? Did you look at data? Like, how do you... I know, like, at the big global companies like Apple, there's a lot of data-driven decisions. Mm. How does it work in sort of a style base when it's a very more of a sort of creative... Well, I guess they're all creative products, but I'm curious just how you decided what you're going to go into next, or how did you decide what product to do next? Was it based on a previous bestseller? Mm.
So we, early on in the business, went offline from our e-commerce only model and started getting into wholesale. And the reasoning was pretty vicious, according to everyone else in the retail business and the men's fashion industry, but for me it was very calculated. We got as many wholesalers as we could to sell our products in physical retail around the country to figure out what products they were asking for and to figure out where in the country our products sold. So we had about 50 retailers up until 2016, who were pushing our product and then coming back to us and going, ooh, our customers keep asking for a tie in this design or a scarf in this design or a pocket square. And then we started to figure out where the products were selling. One of those areas that surprised us was Pretoria. So we then, when we started opening our physical locations, we looked at the wholesalers and who sold best and just opened stores in the same centers and then stopped supplying the wholesalers and started taking on the market. So we used our partners to kind of figure out what our next iterations were. We've had lots in the pipeline. And I think the key thing here is there are lots of competitors who've launched since we launched and copy us almost exactly the same names for our socks, the same designs of our socks, and they rush. We are very slow moving. We're very calculated, and we're very thorough in our product development. So we've been developing boxer shorts for a year and a half. That's with different factories, with different designs, with different cuts. I wear them, then I test them, then I redesign them. And I don't know anything about fabric design. So I take my drawings or my little cut out boxer shorts that I've cut myself with my partner, and we take them to the CMT. CMT is cut, make, trim. It's a factory that makes stuff. And we say, please make these for us. And then you pay for the sample. Year and a half in production, and now we're bringing out socks and jocks, whereas our competitors launch with socks, launch with jocks, hope for the best, don't know anything about what they're doing, and then crumble. And that's happening. So we're very calm and calculated about our product iterations.
Okay, that makes sense, because it's interesting when you have so many different product verticals, so you're iterating within a vertical and then iterating sort of horizontally. So I've always found it curious how you decide what to do and when.
It's so intense. Your comments about inside of a vertical and then deepening and widening the ranges is such a difficult one. So we've got socks that just don't hit. So we'll launch a new design, and I still do the designs to this day, 5 years in. And we'll launch one that I love. We launched one recently called the Campbell. It's like an updated Argyle. Interestingly, a little segue, it's called the Campbell because the Argyle design was designed in a little town in Scotland called Campbell. So that's why we called it the Campbell.
Okay, I clearly have zero style sense, but what is the
Argyle? The Argyle is like that diamond shape that got stripes through it. It's like Pringle. Pringle have a lot of Argyle in their designs.
Very old school cross-hatched.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I'll post a little photo.
Some Argyle.
There may be some other style lacking people out there.
And we love that design and it tanked.
Really?
It just doesn't sell. So we've got, there's lots of nuance in retail, and we've got fast moving and slow moving stock, and we've got something called trading density. It's how much turnover per square meter you do. If you aren't doing enough turnover per square meter, means your product isn't good enough to move. There's something that they don't like. Your store design is funny. There's not enough feet coming in the store. So you have to iterate all the time to get the most profitable product in your store all the time.
Okay.
That's why when something doesn't work in a big retailer, they just chuck it and move something else in there, because every per square meter matters.
So that's actually leads us to a good segue. So we were walking down earlier and you spotted a little spot that might have appealed to you.
Yeah.
You were saying you have a specific model for your retail. So yeah. Does it relate to size? Do you have a maximum size you'll ever lease? And maybe after that you can give us some insight into the retail apocalypse that you're busy fighting on a daily basis.
So we went from an e-commerce company to physical retail completely accidentally. I was walking down Whale Street with no intention of opening a store, and a friend of mine knows the guy who owns the building that we're now in, and the store had just become available, and it's this small little store, and he said, would be great if you guys moved in here. And I was like, no, thank you. Then the owner came down by happenstance and said, the rent's so cheap. What do you think? And I was like, okay, cool, we'll take it. And he said, you know what, actually, we don't want to have a sock shop in there. We just want to use it as office space. 2 days later, he phoned me, and we took the space, and it's now our flagship store. It's 13 or 14 square meters, which is probably the size of the room we're in right now. And that store paid itself off in 2 months. Then we opened at the waterfront, and that store paid itself off in 2 months. And I'm talking about all the investment up front was paid off in 2 months in profit. And then you start thinking, well, that's a good model. And in retail, actually, that is the model, that if your store capital can be paid off by profit in 3 months, then you've got a model to just roll out. Pump it out. You can then raise millions of rand and just open stores because you've got your model figured out, right? we did have a model figured out, but we didn't realize it. So we then started signing leases for bigger stores. And bigger stores mean a higher trading density that you need, more turnover per square meter. And when you're selling socks, not like selling sunglasses, where you're selling one pair for $5,000. For us to sell 5,000 rands worth of socks, we need to sell 25 pairs of socks. That's intense. Yeah. So we do now have a model. And the model is anything upwards of 20 square meters and lower than 40 square meters. So we've got two stores that are over that. And those stores, we now need to put a deeper product range into to try and get out as much turnover as we can from those stores. Because
on that point, did retail then influence faster product iteration horizontally?
Definitely. Because as entrepreneurs listening will know, the number one thing in a business is survival.
Yeah.
So you're going to sign a 3-year lease. it doesn't matter what you say. Your lease is 3 years and you're paying for 3 years. So do what you have to do to make that money. Otherwise, you're screwed. So yeah, we entered a rapid development phase where we started printing our own socks and printing on socks and doing boxes and doing other things. And yeah, so now we've figured out our model. And the model is 20 to 40 square meters, high foot trafficked areas. We like high streets like Parkhurst or Whale Street or Bree Street. Savile Row one day, that'd be great.
That would be amazing.
Those sorts of places are our model. And we're launching into countries now with a very specific model that I call Clicks to Bricks. We launch with e-commerce. We then enter a wholesale phase where we learn about the market. And then we open our own stores after the data we've got. That is very contrary to how retail is right now. Retail right now is, in South Africa specifically, let's open as many stores as we can and then use that to build an e-commerce play. And we're doing it the other way around.
Okay. It's interesting. So you've almost created a playbook for the approach to everywhere you go.
It has to be that way. You need to minimize your risk, minimize your costs, and maximize your output. And that all sounds very douchey, but the truth is when every single sale counts, if you have one bad day in a store, you've got to catch that up. So we're very specific about how we use our capital now.
Okay.
We weren't in the last 2 years, but we are now.
I want to then take a look at, so you've now gone retail, brick and mortar. Like, what do you, so like, where do you see the Nekari brand going long to term? Like, is it going, do you see other verticals? How do you see yourself sort of approaching, like, is there an end game? Is there something you see as like a final moment where you'll be like, okay, Nekari has made it. I'm a happy man.
No. Like, there's definitely no end game. I read a lot. I read two to three books a month. And in all the reading that I do, the most successful, influential, and content people are those who think in decades and build things that are longer term. So with Nekari, we're building a 20-year business. I'm in no rush. We're iterating with the markets. Our goal is to stay alive. Paul Graham wrote a great essay. If you go to Paul Graham, I think it's paulgraham.com, and look for his Do Not Die essay.
Yeah,
it's brilliant. It's a brilliant piece of writing that every entrepreneur should read. All you have to do is outlast your competitors. All you have to do is move with the market so you stay alive. And right now, retail is intense. It's vicious the world over. We're in a flux where e-commerce is becoming a thing, but its reputation is bigger than it actually is. So everyone thinks that Amazon is killing traditional retail in the US. That's not actually entirely true. It is contributing, but e-commerce in the US only accounts for 14% of retail across the board. In South Africa, that's less than 3% if on a good day. On a bad day, it's 1%. It depends on who you ask. To give those numbers some space here and to quantify them, in South Africa, retail itself is 300 billion rand. In total. That means that e-commerce is less than 6 to 9 billion rand. The big players, 60% of that 6 or 7 billion is taken up by the top 10 websites. Wow. So that means the rest of us are fighting for 2 to 3 billion rand if we're lucky. How do you build a 100 million rand business when there are thousands of sites fighting for 2 billion rand? So to go back to your initial question, South Africa's e-commerce space is 10 years away from being ripe enough to have 100 million rand businesses built out of it. So we're looking overseas now. And our model is really simple. We produce locally and we export. And we export using Amazon, our own websites into Europe and Australia and America. And once we've done that, we'll roll out our physical experiences. So we used to call them sock experiences, our physical store, because it's not about just coming in and buying something. We have a custom branded scent. We have amazing packaging. We have incredibly well-trained staff who look the part. So you come in and you get a style experience when you walk into our stores.
Have you done the custom scent? So do you make the stores smell of the scent?
Yep.
That's the Singapore Airlines play, if I recall correctly.
Yep. So we have that scent in our packaging, on our socks, in our stores. So when you receive a delivery from us in e-commerce and you walk past one of our stores, you'll trigger that you know that smell.
It's one of the things, that Singapore Airlines story sticks with me. They also have a trademark scent that they spray throughout the planes.
And dude, it's so important.
Yeah, because it's a sense. It's something you associate with a brand.
It's an experience.
You can all smell something and get that sort of...
And e-commerce, I've started saying that e-commerce doesn't offer 5 senses. Physical retail catches a customer on 5 senses. E-commerce is just you look, you see, you buy. With a product like mine, you need to touch and smell. You need to talk to my guys and listen to what they're saying. So our physical style experiences give you that five senses experience where you're willing to pay for a product that we're selling. It's not a lowest cost thing. If you want the lowest cost thing, go to Alibaba.com and buy yourself 100,000 pairs of socks. Like, that's not us. We're building a brand.
Yeah. I'm curious. I want to actually unpack the brand side of things. Mm. So you originally... You named the brand and the company after yourself. It still is pretty much, but it's now Nick Harry.
Yep.
Was the initial decision, was it to try and create yourself as the sort of brand entity, the icon behind it? I know you've done some amazing blog posts and you've created some amazing content and you do have a style icon.
Thanks.
You are a style icon.
It's very kind.
But was that the play? Did you want to become so influential that people would sort of just flock to you and imitate and buy and do your thing?
Yeah, it's not an accident that the brand is named after me for a couple of reasons. So the first thing is we started the company and it was called Nick Socks. So we were a sock company. And then we realized that, and all my competitors listening, your model doesn't support socks only. You don't know it yet, but your model doesn't. So we realized this, that to be a 100 million rand or dollar business, you can't just sell socks unless you're in every country in the world. Like Happy Socks, they're in 75 countries and 6,500 stores. So unless you're going that model, you can't just be a sock company. And also, sock companies alone are a race to the bottom. There are hundreds of competitors and it's a race to the price, the lowest common price, and we're not playing that game. So we quickly realized a year and a half in that we needed to rebrand and increase our pricing. So a little quick story about that. I was in a flat panic about the pricing. The margins didn't support what we wanted to do going forward. The name was wrong because how do you have Nick Socks ties or Nick Socks jocks?
Makes sense.
Happy Socks try and do, and they've done it successfully in their model, but we looked at them and we were like, that's not what we want to do. We want to be more like Paul Smith or Ben Sherman or Thomas Pink, where they built a style brand and a personality in their clothing. So within the space of a month, we changed our name and doubled our pricing. And the guys at Superbalist gave me the best advice ever. I was in a panic and I was like, guys, I'm going to change my name. You guys did it. What's the best advice you can give me? And they were like, no one gives a shit. No one cares. Just change your name. And you'll have people moan for a month, and then they'll come back and they'll buy your socks because you've got a good product. So we changed our name and doubled our pricing. And what happened was we lost two or three customers, and within a month, we doubled our turnover.
Amazing.
So branding was a key thing. Now we're called nickharry.com, and that even applies in our stores. It's the Amazon.com model. They weren't Amazon. They were always Amazon.com in everything. And we're the same. We're nickharry.com because we're a full-fledged 360-degree integrated company. I hate all that buzzword stuff, but it's true. You can walk into our store and collect something from our website. You can buy on our website and go into the store and vice versa. So we decided to go for a more esteemed brand with me at the helm. And I do all the PR. I'm the face of the company. And that's kind of how it works. People buy from people, not from big businesses. And I think the downfall of these conglomerates is proof of that.
Okay. It makes sense. I'm keen to also unpack some things around sort of stress, blockages. Like, at the end of the day, those things that keep you up at night. Like, what we're, as entrepreneurs or people trying to do things out differently in a very tough market, we're trying to build things, we're putting ourselves on the line in front of our friends. What keeps you up? And then other than that, how do you find that you manage to break through those stresses or get rid of those blocks?
So this being my 10th or 11th business, I've kind of learned over the years, and my erratic 20s were the biggest lesson here, that being an entrepreneur comes with being pretty manic depressive and bipolar, and that's real. My family has a history of bipolar disorder. I've managed to package that into something that helps my goods be really good and good enough that I can build a business, and my lows be low enough that they drive me back into the highs. But the things that keep me up right now without creating panic attacks are the basics, and it's something that younger entrepreneurs just forget. Cash flow is the only thing that keeps me up at night now. That's it. It's not product development, because that will come. It's not marketing and social and PR. That crap will come. If you don't have cash flow in your business, you are dead tomorrow. So for me, the thing that keeps me up at night is, what are my payment terms? When do I have to pay and who is next? And is it the end of the month and I have to pay salaries and the rentals for all these different shopping centers that we're in? And is there enough money?
It's
brutal.
I used to have to, back in the early fiction days, I mean, paying those bills at the end of the month.
Yeah.
Just logging in and just going through, it's horrific.
Yeah, and your bank limits don't allow you to pay them all in one day. Now, that's how much we're paying out.
Wow. Okay.
And when we've got suppliers, we've got 15 different suppliers who all have different payment terms. And the truth is, whether you're a $100 billion business or a $10,000 business, you have to worry about cash flow.
You're juggling your ins and outs.
Yeah, it's the number one thing you have to worry about. And I swear, if you're listening to this and you're a business person and you don't know what your cash flow is right this minute, go into your bank account and check, because you don't know, and that will sink you tomorrow. So that's what keeps me up. How I get around this, the first thing that I do, and it's one of our core business beliefs, our culture beliefs, is radical candor. I'm brutally honest with everyone. We preach radical candor, and radical candor is a really simple theory that you are honest and positive, not negative, but you're honest with everyone all the time.
Who was the guy? He was on the Tim Ferriss podcast. He has the books where he lived a religious life for a year. He also lived a year of radical candor. I'll try find it and put it in the show notes, but he lived a year where he would only tell the truth.
Yep.
And he met friends of his wife's and had to tell them to their faces, I never want to see you again.
Yeah, and I mean, that's extreme, but being honest, the reason I say honesty is one of the ways I deal with these emotional ups and downs, is the more you lie and hide it, the more you believe your own bull. And when you're believing that rubbish and you're not telling people the truth, no one can relate to you. Then when no one can relate to you, you isolate yourself. So for my years at MoTribe, I would tell everyone everything's fine. Meanwhile, I'd taken a salary cut for the last 8 months and I was earning nothing so that my staff could be paid. And I'd meet with my best friends and be like, no, everything's great, man. The world is awesome. And it was such a lie. Instead of just relating to people on a human level and going, man, this shit is hard.
And you also almost block help.
Opportunity as well. And in help comes opportunity. Mm. So that's one of the ways I deal with it. We are honest in our company. And we struggle with it because a lot of our staff that come on board don't believe it. They don't believe that they can challenge me all the time. I should be the most criticized person in my company. And they just don't believe that if they do that, I won't fire them. They think that I'm not to be challenged, and that's crazy. They're at the coalface of my business, and I want them to be honest. The other way that I've helped this is I started seeing a psychologist on and off. I don't believe a psychologist is someone you should see forever. If you're seeing them forever, they're not helping you. So I started seeing a high-impact psychologist who deals with sports people and CEOs, someone who understands
the stress.
Okay. The way that I phrase it to people is, if you could think of a warehouse where there's no order, that was my mind. And what I did with the psychologist was help put my thoughts in boxes and then pack away the ones that didn't matter and put forward the ones that did.
It's interesting you say that. I'm very glad you segued back, because I'd actually written, I wanted to come back to this, because I agree completely with the psychologist, the life coach. Just having someone you can meet and just offload your shit onto, because I think I feel like I'm also an entrepreneur and I relate in that degree, but we have so much going on in our minds that we can drive the people close to us almost crazy to a degree.
And drive them away from you.
Yeah.
Because they don't relate. The truth is, the people closest to you, unless they're building the business with you, they don't relate. And to be fair, even my partner, we've been together 12 years and she's in the business with me. She's a co-founder, basically. And she doesn't really understand what goes through my brain, because she's got a specific role in the business and it's not the management of the business. Running a company where you're paying 22 people staff and rental on 5 stores and there's no cash flow and you're working on that will keep you up at night. And unless you're in it and sharing it with me, you don't understand. So talking to the people closest to you about this all the time, they're just going to get bored and frustrated that you're always negative. That's the other thing. And Tim Ferriss is very good at talking about this, and he dedicates a lot of his time to this. Gratitude. It's something that I scoffed at for a while, and I like to be negative. And I was told by my psychologist that I'm an adrenaline junkie for negativity. The more negative I am, the more stressed I get. The more stressed I am, the more the adrenaline kicks in physically. It's a physical reaction. The more I have adrenaline, the better I work. So I manufacture stress to work better.
So are you a last minute worker or a panicker?
No, I'm just a constant stressor.
Oh, really?
Constant. I will make up things to make me more anxious so that the physical adrenaline kicks in so I can work harder. And when it's like after a run, you feel better. after an anxiety feeling, I work better.
Because I think that almost relates. See, I'm a last minute.
Okay.
Like, I will often leave things to the last. I mean, so, even just like anything, I'll leave it to the last minute, and it's that same feeling of, oh my God,
anxious,
I've got to.
And then you focus, you get into the zone. So one of the ways I've combated that, which is what most of the leading thinkers right now in the space are saying, is be grateful. So just think about what you're grateful for the day, and then the panic and the stress goes away. And it's true. Whether you have no cash flow in your business today or not, we've been a business for 5 years. That's longer than most businesses stay alive. I'm grateful for that. I work with people that I really want to work with. I'm grateful for that too. So even though they screw up from time to time, I'm still grateful that I have them and that they're there. And that gives me perspective. The other thing that really helps, and I have to remind my team this all the time, is no one dies if we don't get our stock take done. We sell socks for a living.
It's like, don't sweat the small stuff.
Don't sweat anything. We sell socks for a living. We sell style for a living. We're not a life or death situation. This is not Doctors Without Borders. There is no need to go into a flat out panic and depression over this company, because there will be 10 others in my life. And
that's a very good outlook to have.
It's imperative. Otherwise,
people think every tiny little thing, like, oh my, if I forget to do X, the end of the world will happen. And it's usually not the case.
We started asking ourselves this question internally, my co-founder, as well as the business. We start saying, is this something worth fighting for? You're arguing with me. Is this particular something you want to put your job on the line for? And if they go, no, we're like, cool, let's move on then. It doesn't matter. Let's move on. And Jeff Bezos, in his most recent SEC letter, shareholder letter, he said that his team have got this great thing that we've adopted. It's called disagree but commit. So you don't have to fight about everything. He disagrees with the decision his board has made, but he'll commit to backing it because he believes they're the best at what they do. So he's not going to fight with them until the cows come home. He's just going to go, I disagree, but I absolutely back you because you're the best people around.
I think, yeah, he's got an interesting outlook on life. He doesn't care about failure. He doesn't seem to let, like, fire phone disaster.
Oh,
like,
phenomenal.
He's had a lot of bad products.
Setbacks.
He's had things happen, but you can almost see he just does it. He's just like, oh, well, forget about that. Let's move on. Let's see if we can turn it into a new Kindle and
also
make that a product.
If you look at failure as learning, so I've stopped saying that I failed. I started saying that I've learned a lot of lessons. Because if you see failure as a lesson, then why not fail as often and as hard and as quickly as you can?
Fail fast is a great...
it is.
I wrote that down the other day. Fail fast, fail quickly.
Yeah, and I mean, Facebook famously says, move fast and break things. Mm. For me, it's about failure specifically. South Africans don't like to fail. And it's wrong. It's the wrong way of thinking. We think of failure as a negativity when, in fact, it's a positive. You've learned what not to do next. So start again and don't do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And then I want to also... Daily habits, routines, hobbies, these sorts of things also play... huge role. Like, for me, running on the mountain, like getting exercise is hugely important. I've injured my ankle, I haven't been able to for a month, and it's put me in almost into a rut because I see it as my major it's an outlet for me. But what do you do when you wake up? Do you have any sort of journaling, meditation? Anything like that? Or how would you approach your day?
Yeah, my day is relatively regimented. Never used to be, but that regiment has started helping me exist. So it depends on whether it's summer or winter. If it's summer, we wake up at about 5. Because
you're an early riser.
Yeah, early riser, and I sleep early. I'm in bed and reading by 9 p.m. and sleeping by 9:30. I worked out, and everyone should do this, just through natural methods. Work out how much sleep you need. I need 8 hours. Like, unequivocally, I need 8 hours. If I get 7 hours, I'm kind of grumpy. If I get less than 7 hours, I'm unplayable. I cannot function. So I make it a priority to not watch enough TV to get me past 9 o'clock. So we watch 20-minute things from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. just to decompress. I wake up at 5 or 6. I check email between 5 or 6 and 10 in the morning. Then I stop checking email because I have a priority list. I can't. Chris Sacker, a famous investor in the U.S., he said email is a to-do list that other people get to decide. And that completely ripped my world apart.
It's amazing. It actually makes perfect sense.
Every time someone emails me, I stop what I'm working on as my priority and I work on what they've asked me to do. And that doesn't work. So I have a list of 3 things for my year that I want to accomplish. And every month I look at those 3 things and I go, is what I'm doing this week going to play into those 3 things? If it isn't, then stop checking.
So you're very macro-focused.
So there's this great book called The Rockefeller Habits. I can't think of the author, but just Google
I'll
that.
I'll put it in the notes.
Yeah, find it on Goodreads. In fact, you can follow me on goodreads.com/Nick Harry. I read and review everything. Well. Yeah. So good. The Rockefeller habits basically dictate that the way he managed John D. Rockefeller, the way he managed his management team was he gave them the high level 5-year strategy and then worked backwards from that down to the day. So 5-year, 3-year, 2-year, 1-year, 6-month, quarter, month, day, week, and then said, cool. What you're doing today, does that impact your week? What you're doing this week, does it impact your month? Month to quarter, quarter to year, year to 5-year. If what you're doing today doesn't in some way affect your 5-year strategy, back off. Then let's reassess the 5-year strategy every month, and if it's wrong, let's shift it. So we're doing something similar, because otherwise all you do is deal with the daily email.
And you get too micro-focused.
Yeah, and as someone, if we had been more macro-focused in our business, we probably wouldn't have opened so many stores just prior to the retail collapsing. We would have been able to see the macro.
Okay. We're running out of, we're going to start closing off, but just back to, we didn't really finish on the daily routines. So how do you approach fitness, health? What supplements do you take?
And I don't take any supplements. I probably should. I drink a fair amount of Greek coffee. I've become a Greek coffee fan at the moment.
What is Greek coffee?
It's finely ground coffee that you cook in a pot.
It's quite thick. And
yeah, so the Turkish people call it Turkish coffee. The Greeks call it Greek coffee.
Okay,
same thing, exactly the same.
It's an acquired taste.
Yeah, it is. It's in my blood. So I wake up in the morning. Jen and I alternate. She mostly runs the dogs in the morning. I take them in the afternoon. So having two dogs has been a pretty interesting thing for us. If I had to go back, I probably wouldn't have dogs, but having them now forces Jen and I, because we work together, to come home, not talk about work, walk the dogs and decompress.
Okay.
Cooking is a really big part of my daily habits. Cooking relaxes me. It helps me not think about work. It takes my mind off things.
Favorite meal?
No, anything. Just cooking from scratch or from a recipe.
Specific diets, paleo?
So Jen is a vegan.
Oh, really?
So we cook vegan at home almost every day. I don't eat meat most days. I'll maybe eat meat or fish once a week. So yeah, very healthy diet.
I've been seeing a huge uptick in vegan lifestyle at the moment, it seems.
It's hard to avoid when you dig into it. So as I said earlier, as a company, we don't use any animal products either.
Okay.
And I do firmly believe that in the next decade, maybe in the next 5 decades, we're going to look back at our treatment of animals and we're going to regret it. We're going to think that the way we treated animals was horrific. And just a little last side, I love my little side notes. One of the, I think it's Virgin Galactic, they were looking to build their spaceships, and Richard Branson and his team looked at what fabric they were going to use on the chairs, and they decided against leather. And the reason is really simple. They thought that if they ever get into a situation where they meet alien intelligent life and they are sitting on the skin of another animal, that alien life will think that they were, that we were hostile. And when I heard that, I was like, man, that is really messed up.
That is.
So as a company,
we
can't bring ourselves to do it. In our lifestyle, we're more animal friendly centric. So that's my daily habits. The main thing for me, and if you're struggling with your time, just check your email for the first or last 2 hours of the day. Then wait for people to respond a day later. Just in 24-hour gaps. Trust me, you're not important enough that you need to answer your email today. If it's important enough, someone will phone you.
Awesome. I think we've like really unpacked and covered quite a lot. It's been a very interesting chat.
Yes.
If you wanted to just say a final closing, let's not say quote, but a thought, what would you like to share and say?
So our theme for the year at Nick Harry is strong opinions weekly held. And that translates to don't think you know what you know. You don't know. So if you think that you are making a red sock forever, try a blue sock. If you think you're only a sock company, try be a tie company. Blow up everything you think you know about your world, your beliefs, your system. Challenge them all the time. Otherwise, all you're going to become is stale.
Makes perfect sense. It's been a really interesting and amazing chat. I'll put all the links, show notes, social, where you can follow Nick and where you can buy his amazing socks. And not only socks, actually a whole bunch of product. Thanks so much for your time.
It's an absolute pleasure.
It's been
pleasure.
Amazing. Awesome. That's the first guest on The Innovators, done and dusted.
Well, that was the first episode of The Innovators. I hope you enjoyed the chat with Nick. I certainly did. There's some amazing takeaways there. I think everyone can learn quite a bit from what Nick had to say. As always, the show notes are available at theinnovators.co/Nick. You can also get links to all the stuff spoken about, different people, different articles, a whole bunch of stuff right there, as well as links to follow Nick and go hopefully buy some socks from nickharry.com. As always, really appreciate feedback. If you have anything nice to say or any sort of constructive criticism, please send it my way. You can get hold of me on all the social networks at TKennedySA. But again, all those links can be found at theinnovators.co. The next episode will be out in the next 2 weeks, so keep an eye out and keep on listening. If you're enjoying it, share the word, drop a review, and let me know what you think. Awesome. Cheers.